hospital down in the Tampa area, the patients that were in condition that served with diet patients got free Uberides for 6 months to the doctor for all their follow-up visits.
I think I'm in.
Thank you. How are you guys doing?
Good. Looking at the pie charts. That's very cool.
That's great. But you should figure out what I'm going to say.
Yes.
Anybody can make it half a focus. He's the man. You're talking to the right council for the next 5 months.
I promised you if I can stay on that.
2 o'clock?
I'm 1:30. I'm sorry. 1:30.
Testing. Okay. All right, we're going to get started. Good afternoon and welcome to the Special Committee on Access to Healthcare Workshop. I just like to welcome everyone for coming out. And I'm going to introduce my two co-chairs, Jennifer and Paul. Either one of y'all like to say something quick?
Thank you, everybody, for being here. Really appreciate the time. And definitely want feedback today as much as you guys can share. We need to hear from you. So thank you.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
So before we get started, we're going to start from over there on the panel. And just go.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Annie Seeger with the Regional Council. I'm Beth Payne, the CEO of the Regional Council.
Pam Wilcox, ECA, at large with 5.
Michael Boylan, District 6, and chair of the committee.
And Paul Sapia, Population Health for Humana.
Sam Newby, City Councilman.
Jennifer Ryan, CEO of Volunteers of Medicine, Jacksonville.
Charles Moreland, Mayor's Office.
Ron Salem, City Council Group 2 at large.
Okay, before we turn over to Jennifer and Paul, I'm going to let the chairman of the committee say a couple words.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. Had a marvelous conversation this morning on the homelessness issue. As we all know, these are all interrelated. And as near as I can tell from the conversations we've had with the other two working groups, the cohesiveness of this entity, I think, is very, very strong. And I think as we move forward, as I was just sharing with Ms. Payne, I'm looking forward to the deliverables that you all bring to the table in terms of recommendations going forward. But thank you for being here.
Also, Mr. Vice President, Ron Salem, you got a couple words you want to say?
Thank you. Councilmember Newby, it was a great meeting this morning. I'm just here to help Councilmember Boylan and the other co-chairs in any way that I can, but it's just great to sit and listen and learn. Thank you.
All right. And once again, I want to thank everyone for coming. We have a lot of talent in this room, and I think the city of Jacksonville is going to be a better city for this. Now I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer and Paul for the overview.
I guess I'll start.
Ladies first.
Ladies first, that's right. So I just want to share, in case you haven't known, if you're getting the emails at our first meeting, which thank you for those of you that attended that, there were some data points that were mentioned. And so there was a flyer that was created with a link to all those data sources. I'm not sure if I saw a copy, but if you got an email from Pamela, she included that, because that was really our fact-finding data. We heard from Susan Grinch. And so I want to, I'm excited about today. We're starting learning about best practices. We're going to hear from the city. We're going to hear from Jenny. She is on her way from another presentation, so she will be here. So we're excited to hear about that and really thinking about how what we can, starting to think about how we're going to impact improving access to care. We're getting to, you know, closer to where we need to make these decisions. So just start thinking about what you're hearing and what we want to do to really make an impact and take action as a part of this work group. So thank you for all being here.
All right. And thank you, everybody, for being here. Kind of like Jennifer said, we had a great conversation the first time we got together. There is so much expertise, so much knowledge, so much experience in this room that we really need to leverage this to be able to make actionable moves and things that we can really, you know, change within the community. This stuff has been going on for entirely too long, a lot of these issues. And so I'm glad to be a part of this, and I'm glad that you're all here. And again, like I say every time, if there's not somebody in this room that needs to be in the room, please, you know, feel free to invite them, make the connection, share the notes, and get some input. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And before we bring up our guest speaker, after the speaker speaks, we're going to do just a little bit different. The speaker's going to have 15 minutes, and whoever wants to speak will come up to the microphone. We're going to start from that row first and then work our way. Come up to the microphone. You have 30 seconds to ask your question, and Dr. Morland will have 30 seconds to answer the question. So let's.
Where's the timer? Do we have
Ms. Wilcox?
The timer. Okay.
So, because last time it was a little elongated, so we're trying to kind of, you know, narrow it down a little bit. So now I'm going to introduce Dr. Morland. He's the Deputy Chief Administrative Officer for the City of Jacksonville, and he's going to talk about what Mayor Curry plans to invest. Go ahead.
All right. Good afternoon. And just for the record, it wasn't because of me being long
way. Right. It was.
When it comes to things, I want to make sure we put that on the record. Anyway, it's very nice to be here with everyone. We had a robust conversation this morning, and I appreciate everybody's attentiveness. I would be remiss if I did not say how appreciative I am of all the work that everybody in this room does on behalf of the citizens of Jacksonville. I can tell you, for being in city government for 32 years, this year, we cannot do it without the people that are in this room and the others that are actually doing the work out there right now. We could not do it. So thank you for the commitment and investment that you make every day to make our city a better place to live, work, and play. The other thing I want to mention is that none of this stuff that I'm doing this morning or this afternoon would be possible without the help of our strategic partnership group, Sarah Smith and Don Lockhart. They have been instrumental in providing me the tools that I need to present this information to the team, as well as our neighborhoods department, Tom Daly and Chiquita Moore. They've been helpful in ensuring that we have accurate information to share with the team. So I want to thank them for all of their efforts. And then finally, I have to thank Rachel Zimmer and Ryan for making sure that I'm where I need to be. And they've done an outstanding job in ensuring that I'm here and information is available to the team. So with that, I just want to talk about you see in the PowerPoint, it's really the mayor's investment in these quality of life areas. In order to really appreciate where we're trying to go, we have to take a little bit of a walk down memory lane to see where we've been. And so what we decided to do was take a strategic look at the past three years of evidence-based data related to our investments in the areas of affordable housing, homelessness, and then as well as our health care. And so that's what we've done. This is a snapshot in time. Keep in mind that data changes every day. And the dollar amounts will change as the data changes as well. So just our last 3 years, a snapshot, but we could not do it without all of our partners in here.
A good point to mention is that the degree of separation between agencies and what you provide and what you do is sometimes can get obscured in the idea that it's real straightforward. It's not. You know, a lot of things are, you know, cross paths, and we have to acknowledge that. And therefore, we created a fourth category, which reflects where housing and homelessness and healthcare really intersects with each other, so that the lines, you know, that we consider at times are blurred. So here we go, the administration. This is our focus. This has been the mayor's focus from the very beginning. You know, public safety and economic development, neighborhoods, youth, and then the health and wellness. The mayor believes so much about that, and to the point that he decided to have a strategic partnership office within the mayor's office, because we could not do it without that connectivity with all of our partners. And there was no one better suited to take on that responsibility than the person that we have in that space now, and that's Don Lockhart. The many, many years, three or four decades of being in that space helps us in the mayor's office to formulate a game plan in order to address the needs and concerns of our nonprofit partners. In that strategic partnership came the community framework, GOES framework. That framework is nationally recognized. Go to that. It's a nationally recognized framework that we utilize as a model to help us and municipalities really look how we can impact our community in a very positive way. It is associated with those community impacts. So therefore, our investments, the things that we do from a primary and secondary perspective, should be geared around these community goal frameworks. And so today, our goal was to focus on 3, 8, and 9. Third one, vibrant and thriving neighborhoods. The 8th, health and wellness, and food security and nutrition. So moving forward, these are some areas that we'll go into detail a little bit further, but the city of Jacksonville submits a consolidated plan to HUD every 5 years, and we're in year 2 of that 5-year consolidated plan. And therefore, in addition to all of that, related to our strategy, we work alongside a bunch of critical thinking individuals that help us develop these strategies, and one being the Florida Housing Coalition with Jamie Ross. She's the consultant that we use here and partner with to help develop our housing blueprint. Ms. Ross, I didn't mention this earlier, but in our first meeting, but Ms. Ross will be here for our strategy session in December that Don Lockhart and the team will be putting on here in the city of Jacksonville. So the goal is to keep everybody connected, having that continuity, and ensure that we are following the important work that we see. So when we look at this slide here, homelessness and housing and healthcare, obviously we're very proud of the urban rest stop and all the other things that we've been able to provide some funding to support. I would be remiss if I did not say, without our city council being a part of this process every step of the way, this funding strategy and the things in which we've been able to do would not exist. The mayor has been very intentional in these areas, but obviously he can't do it without the support of our city council. All city council members are very much involved in this process. So our Jacksonville Housing a Partnership, we're very thrilled about the Community Land Trust. And we heard the mayor do a presentation on that about a month or so ago related to the Community Land Trust. It's important to note this is the first in the state to have passed the first look ordinance. And that first look ordinance allowed for the Community Land Trust to be the first right of refusal for city-owned properties, surplus properties. That's a big win for our city. The $12 million investment in the Schoesbacher Enterprise Village will create a large supply of affordable housing and units to advance our goals of ending homelessness. And in our expedient deployment of $115 million related to COVID relief, we were able to do that along with the mortgage, rent, and correction, the emergency rental assistance plan. That was a lot of funding that went out toward that, and I couldn't thank the team enough for their committed effort in getting $115 million out to the community that was in such a dire need. People were considering losing their homes, foreclosures, and so forth. We were able to provide that resource to them. And then again, Jacksonville is also the first city to implement Senate Bill 1339. I'll get to that. Into a local ordinance which also allows for the further development of affordable housing by reducing the zoning and land use burden. And here's another slide I just want to mention, touch on for you, is that these are all the investments. The city have different housing investments that we've been able to work closely with our neighborhoods department to make sure that folks have access to this funding. These are real dollars going to real people. And the goal is to prevent a household from losing their home, right? That's one of the goals. And to become and keep them from becoming homeless. That's the goal. And the strategy is to serve as an important role of our housing landscape to our citizens over time. We pushed out more money in those areas than what people can recognize. And again, this is over a three-year period, and which is why I wanted the council and others to be able to see that we're not starting at functional zero. We're not at zero. We have done quite a bit of work. There's always opportunities to do better, but we haven't started at zero. And let me back up by simply saying this. The presentation that I'm doing today is not to spike the ball in any means. We know we haven't finished the work. We get all of that. But it's just important for us to realize that we've done some incredible things in this short period of time, and I'm only highlighting 3 years of those investments. A couple charts. The chart showcases about $180 million dedicated to affordable and workforce housing. No, we're not here for that today, but it's important. I shared it in our earlier meeting. I'm going to share it with you so that you can get the big picture view of it all. The homeless strategy, we can be very proud that we have our urban rest station. We've done well with that. Our task force that the mayor produced over time to look at ways in which we can, you know, connect and coordinate to try to, you know, reduce the amount of homelessness that we see in our city. We see that 35% decrease since 2015 and 52% decrease over the last 10 years. And to me, I don't know about you, but that's amazing work that has been done. And that all, you know, kind of coordinated around that task force that was put in place in 2017. And then these are some of our partners that we're involved with, the strategies that we work with others in order to accomplish those goals. And I won't read all of that, but just so that you'll know that we have partners that we work with to consistently allow for that to exist. And then the prevention and the diversion programs that we have, these are some of the example of programs that we, you know, we funded and provide some assets to that are highlighted there. We're very proud of the work that we've done. In fact, there's many times that our city has become recognized as a national model on how we even and got engaged in our COVID response to ensure the safety of our homeless population. Many people don't realize that when we did some of this work in the homeless space, you know, we had zero positives associated with all of that. Because we immediately got involved with it initially, and we were able to provide some stability in that area, so we had zero positives in that area. Very proud of it. So that task force has been very beneficial to increasing access and entry points into the system, and the urban rest stop is the key investment that we should really be proud of. And these are some of the investments. This chart reports the investments to support emergency assistance to homeless totaling over $14 million. Now, $14 million is just dedicated to that specific area, but you got to remember what I said earlier. There are a lot of crossover that intersects with different organizations, that number is driven much higher than the 14 that we're talking about. So that's just 14 specifically. But when you start talking about nonprofit organizations and their different slices of the pie, that number is probably way higher than that. Some of the key things to that number, $2.3 million in 2021 for change in homelessness, $450,000 to PSG funding for the Hubbard House, $390,000 to change in homelessness for coordinated entry, support through various funding sources, and then $180,000 from 19 to 22 for Gateway Community Service for Homeless Prevention Program, and over $500,000 to our Military Affairs and Veterans Homeless Reintervention Program. There's a lot that's into that. So our successful navigation through the pandemic was a result of the many strategic investments featured on this slide. As you can see, over the last 9 years, the city of Jacksonville has invested over $260 million in UF Health Jacksonville Indigent Care, health care services, over our investment of over $39 million for COVID-19 vaccination testing, and our $95 million capital improvement plan that we have been able to put into play based on this past budget that was just passed this past Tuesday, a week ago this week. And then here's some prevention and intervention things that we've been involved with. These are areas that we have invested in as it relates to healthcare strategies and diversify our investment in both prevention and intervention. These are some of the things that sometimes I believe we forget that we've been able to engage in. And again, I won't read them all, but these are some of the strategic investments that our city dollars have been very supportive of. And in this chart, it shows over $306 million in investment in healthcare prevention and intervention. And some of those key points are $1 million to the Duval Safety Net Collaborative Agencies, $5 million to KHA Nutrition Services, $2.8 million to Northwest Jacksonville Economic Development Fund, and $3.4 million to Gateway Community Services, just to name a few. And then there's just a graph of our continued investment over time in healthcare related to UF. If you can see back in 2014-15, it was $26 million, it's up to $40 million now. That proposal is now approved through the budgetary process that went through last week. But you can see where those investments are at. And then the $95 million that I mentioned that is part of our capital improvement funding for some infrastructure and capital needs for UF Health. We are investing in our indigent health care at levels that most people may not even recognize or know. And then finally on this one, $4 million between FY18 and 22, the Duval County Health Department for a variety of programs associated with health care needs of Health Zone 1. And this chart right here, you don't have to add all the numbers up. I'll provide them to you. $528 million worth of investments by the city over the last 3 years related to health care. So as stated before, there is a fourth category. That's a combination. It's important for me to mention this. I would be remiss if I didn't do this because the ladies did such a wonderful job prepping this part. So I want to read this to you. The fourth category, which shows where housing and homelessness and healthcare intersects with each other, it reflects funding that fits within more than one of the focus areas. The COVID-19 relief category similarly reflects funds allocated to organizations that focus on one or more of these focus areas. Of course, philanthropic and private investments are also critical to understand in order to ensure you have a full scope of the investment and opportunities there. Just important for you to know, there's a lot of intersecting of that, of those dollars with organizations. And then this chart just really showcases the total funding in all three categories that gets you to that $528 million that I just mentioned and talked about. And finally, I'll summarize it with this, and I think this is a very important slide to say, and I'll get right to the meat of it. Everything that I communicated to you today was evidence and data-driven. Evidence-based, data-driven. These are the investments that we as a city have been able to provide over 3 years. again, cannot do it without our city council saying yes to these dollars being spent in the community. But in order for you and this committee and others to really come up with a plan of a type to address some of the missing needs that you may believe that we need to take a good look at, then the last little paragraph there, as government is only one part of the equation, it is our strong recommendation that you also conduct the same landscape analysis of the private and philanthropic investments made in these three areas to ensure you have an accurate picture of the gaps. And the bottom line, without such information, you will not be able to make an informed slate of recommendations to this committee. So you really do need to do an analysis. But in order for you to get to the analysis, you need to know where we've been. And this is what this opportunity that I'm providing today gives you. So thank you. I hope I lasted within that 15 minutes. If not, I apologize.
You did. Let's give it again. So do we have any questions for Dr. Marlin? We don't have any questions for Dr. Marlin? No questions?
I like that.
Dr. Moore, you must have did a good job. With this group, is no question, so you did a really good job. Okay. Now we're going to... Because this is the last chance. Any questions for Dr. Moreland?
Mr. Chair, can I say something? If you do have any questions and I'm not here, the subject matter experts that I mentioned in the very beginning, they are truly the subject matter experts in this area, in this space. Please, Sarah, Don, Chiquita, Tom, please connect with them.
All right. So now we're going to go best practice with Jennifer.
So at this point, I want to introduce you all to Jenny O'Donnell. She is the administrator of Jack's Care Connect. We heard a little bit about some of the city's investments in that. But I want to say thank you to Jenny for coming. She just gave another presentation and hurried back over here. So be gentle with her, but ask lots of good questions. As one of the partners that helped to create Jack's Care Connect, and I see other community partners in the group. This is something we're really proud of. This is a collaboration between 7 free clinics that decided they wanted to work together and decided how they wanted to work together. And we're so glad to have Jenny leading this cause. There's been a lot of positives. And the reason we invited her is a lot of, in the first meeting, there were a lot of concerns that people had that Jack's Care Connect is addressing. So we thought it would be good to have her come talk about what we're doing. So please ask questions when she wraps up. She's only going to be presenting for like 2 hours. You have 15 minutes, but you should be fine. So I'm going to turn it over to Jenny. Jenny, thank you for being here so much.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jenny O'Donnell. I'm the administrator for Jack's Care Connect. I have a great presentation. It wasn't specifically designed for this audience, so I know a lot of you probably already know a little bit about the healthcare disparities we have in Duval County. But I'm going to deliver this presentation and see if you guys have any questions. I have a ton of data in my head that's also not in this presentation, so open for lots of great questions afterwards. So Jack's Care Connect is a 3-year pilot. It is a shared initiative of the Duval Safety Net Collaborative. So we are a shared project of Agape Health, Community Health Outreach, Muslim American Social Services, Mission House out of the beach, Sulzbach are both locations, and Volunteers in Medicine, as well as WeCare Jacksonville. So WeCare serves as the fiscal and administrative hub for this project. Our shared vision is that every resident of Duval County has access to high-quality, comprehensive health care, regardless of their insurance status or their ability to pay. So what that really means is we're connecting individuals in Duval County who are uninsured and living at or below 350% of poverty to a primary care medical home through our Duval Safety Net Collaborative Clinic Partners. We also do this by looking at the whole person, and we examine their social determinants of health as well. We want to understand, we know if you have a doctor that doesn't solve all your problems. We want to make sure that we're addressing things like transportation, access to food, people who have two or three jobs, or some that need employment, any of those other issues that you can think about that prevent someone from making health care their number one priority. So a little bit of history on Jack's Care Connect. This has been, I've been with the project for about 2 years now, but the conversation started more than 10 years ago. Different stakeholders and collaborators and clinic leaders and hospital partners and whoever, all those people you can imagine, those great minds came together and really wanted to have a conversation around how do we systematize access to healthcare through the safety net clinics. We have these great partners. You're all very lucky in that we do have a lot of free clinics and our federally qualified healthcare centers, but a lot of individuals, when they're leaving the ER or having a medical crisis, they don't know how to access it. So if you don't know how to access it, you go back to the ER. So we also had an opportunity to bring in some third-party consultants through support from Baptist Health to really have deeper conversations about addressing this need. And from those, from La Piana Consulting, we were able to come up with the idea of Jack's Care Connect, which was then, we saw some seed funding, and then the idea was launched, and the 3-year pilot came into formation. Alrighty, so this is the stuff that you probably already know. If you have insurance, healthcare is a little bit more streamlined. Not always easy, but a little bit more straightforward. You have a primary care doctor, you know where to go if you need specialty care, you know where to go after you've had that specialty care, go back to your doctor, do a follow-up, you'll feel well again, go back to your doctor. It's all just kind of cyclical and fairly straightforward. There's a number on the back of the card that you can call. They'll answer your questions. There's websites you can go to. It's really relatively straightforward. However, if you don't have insurance, your journey looks a little bit more like this, like a hurricane model. It's a bit chaotic. It's a bit unclear on what path are you supposed to follow. The clients in which we serve, they don't always know how to access one of our clinic partners. They don't always know, where do I go to get this document notarized? You know, how many paycheck stubs do I have to bring to my first appointment? How am I going to get there? I don't have transportation. So that journey to healthcare looks a little bit more, you know, chaotic. You guys are probably aware that we are a non-expansion Medicaid state. Yeah, so that's also a big problem here. A lot of individuals ask us, why are your clients just not applying for Medicaid? Well, they don't really qualify. It's very hard to get Medicaid in Florida if you're not pregnant, lower-income pregnant woman, or child living at low income. So Medicaid is not the solution. Nor is the Affordable Care Act, because it only provides subsidies for people making about $12,500 a month. So if you don't make $12,500 or so a year, you don't qualify for subsidies. Huge gap, huge problem. More than 400,000 people in the state of Florida don't have access to affordable health care. So for Jack's Care Connect, we did a deep dive into, well, what are the actual, what are the problems here? What's the data? For Duval County. So we know that about 2020, about 18% of our residents don't have health insurance. That's about 114,000 individuals. Of those, about 41% are living at or below 200% of poverty. So that's a total of about 47,000 individuals who don't have the means to acquire health insurance and who are uninsured. So these are the clients, these are the individuals that we're working with Jack's Care Connect. So who we serve as Jack's Care Connect, the criteria, individuals that are 18 to 64, so adults living in Duval County, who are living at or below 250% of the federal poverty guidelines, so making about $33,000 a year or less, and are residents of Duval County. As of today, we are just about 2 years into the pilot program. We have received about 1,500 referrals into Jack's Care Connect, primarily coming from our local hospital ED systems, as well as our community partnerships. About 62% of those are currently receiving services, and so they are in care with Jack's Care Connect. So we love to talk about this because we truly are we're a collaborative, we're a collective. So we represent all of our clinic partners. Everyone contributes to the cost of care so that we can exist as a program and provide care for our clients as they're coming through JAKS Care Connect. So we wanted to have a look at, well, what is this value? What value are the clinic partners really investing in the success of JAKS Care Connect? And so the average cost of care for somebody who's uninsured and who's doing self-pay for primary care annually is about $1,100. I do think this number is on the low side. It's probably higher than that. When you add in prescriptions and, you know, follow-up and all those other appointments. So for our, that's a contribution from our clinic partners of about $2.2 million as a cost of donated care that they're bringing to the table for JAKS Care Connect. They've committed to serving 2,000 individuals throughout the three-year pilot period. If those same people went to the emergency room, we know the average cost of care for a single visit is about $4,000 if you're uninsured. So that same, those same 2,000 people utilizing the emergency room would be a cost of about $8.5 million. So collectively, the clinic partners, JAKS Care Connect, is having a collective impact of about $10 million, if not more, towards cost of care and savings. All right, so we are getting close to 2 years into the pilot. At this point, we're 42% towards the pilot goal. We have about 850 active clients right now who we've served, uninsured adults. About 87% of them have scheduled or pending appointments for care for at one of our clinic partners, and of those, about 71% have completed appointments. So what this does demonstrate is the project's working. JAKS Care Connect is creating a pathway for individuals who are lower income and who are uninsured in Duval County to access a primary care medical home in their building. And so this is really fantastic for us to have the opportunity to start looking at the stories that the data is telling us. That's our team. We're comprised of myself, three navigators, well, they're patient health advocates. They're the ones that are really helping to work directly with our clients so that they have a single point of contact they can talk to about not only setting up their primary care appointments, but also maybe transportation to those appointments. They might also want to ask about food stamps or how can I get to a food distribution this weekend. You know, what other resources are there? I need mental health. We have over 174 different relationships with different community partners who we vetted and who we work with to connect our clients to when they need those other resources. And we also have an admin and marketing coordinator and a national health coordinator program. So some of what we learned throughout the course of the pilot is that we are a very people-centric, a human-centric organization. We're not able to really help these clients if we can't establish a trusting relationship with them. So the patient health advocates are really the ones that are building those relationships with our patients. Our patients come to us and they're not always telling us tales of fantastic experiences. They're not always treated well going through other systems, and they've had to tell their story many, many times. So that trust is really important for patient health advocates to establish that relationship with clients. So that takes a lot of time, an investment of time from our team working with clients, but it allows that our patient health advocates to be that point person that they come to when they pretty much need anything. And if we can't find them what they need, we'll do the research and help connect them to that, that care. We've learned that our cases are very complex, so I think the whole point of a lot of what's happening here today is we understand you can't separate lack of access to health care from all these other important needs like housing, being unhoused, I mean, all these other critical issues in Jacksonville. So we're dealing with clients who are facing an array of different crises in their lives. Sometimes they don't have a place to live. Sometimes they're living in their car. Sometimes we're working with Ukrainian refugees who just arrived here to this country and left everything they had. Talking to people who just left the ER and found out, you know, they went in there because they had, you know, some sore throat or gastrointestinal issues and they left, now they have cancer. So these are not like light, simple cases that we can manage within a couple of hours, or we spend a lot of time working with clients to help them manage all the different resources and layers that they need to. It's really hard to make healthcare your number one priority when you don't know where you're going to sleep at night. What else can I tell you about that? Our number of public options referrals are a lot higher than we really expected to. And in a way, this is a good thing. We help navigate applications for your health and contract, as well as the Affordable Care Act. We have some private insurance partners with Florida Blue, as well as some partners with Medicaid. So a lot of times we're helping our clients not only get into a primary care medical home, but also look at what other options might be good for them. For complex health issues, insurance is really a best-case scenario. You have a health city contract, it's fantastic for somebody who's going to need extensive surgeries and care. So we originally thought about 10% of our clients would need this support, and now we're discovering it's closer to about 18 to 20%. We serve all zip codes. So this map up here, the purple, the darker purple, is where we have a higher density of clients. And then the map next to it is our health zone. So you can see in red is health zone 1. We anticipated that most of our clients would come from health zone 1, although they do, some do. We're finding that the majority are coming from other zip codes as well. There's not a zip code in Duval County we don't touch. And it's not surprising that some are coming from the more rural outlying zip codes, where there's a lack of transportation and lack of resources in general. Our demographics are kind of fairly even across the board. We have about 58% of our clients are white, about 35% are African American, and then we have a variety of other races as well. Gender is split, kind of surprisingly, down the middle. We see more women, but we have about 55% are female, with 43% being male, and about 20% identify as being Hispanic or Latino. So some interesting things that we ask at intake is, and this is where, to me, it starts to get exciting. We know that we ask them, within the past 12 months, how many times have you used the emergency room? So about 75% of our clients during intakes answer, yeah, between 1 and 3 times. So that's a lot of people who are utilizing and depending on the emergency room for their care. So this is not great for lots of reasons, but it's really not good for that person. You don't have the wraparound care that you get with a primary care doctor. You don't do your screenings. You don't get diagnostic testing all the time. It's really an episodic experience to help somebody with what's going on right then and there. It does not produce optimal health care results. So that's a heavy dependency. We also ask them where would you go if you had a minor illness? If you had a sore throat, if you had the flu, where would you go? So again, not surprisingly, about 50% said the emergency room. About 12% said urgent care, and about 25% said they wouldn't do anything at all. They would just kind of throw it out. So both of these data sets indicate a high dependency on our emergency rooms from the uninsured. We also learned that about 27% lack reliable transportation. I'm sure that's not shocking to anyone in this room. It's very difficult to make it to appointments if you don't have transportation. It's also difficult to get documents notarized. It's difficult to go change your ID card, to pick up those paycheck stubs, to all those support appointments as well. So we do partner with United Way, 211's medical lift program to help make sure that our clients have access to transportation. And that is our number one utilized resource. We have 174 resources that we connect to, and that one we use pretty much daily. Some other slides that are not on here that are interesting are I can't remember the exact number, but I want to say about 68% of our clients at intake also indicate that they have insecure housing, and about 21% have a fear of losing their housing. So again, painting that picture that there's a lot of complexities going on with our clients that are making it hard to make healthcare their number one priority. We also know about 93% of our clients haven't seen a dentist within the past 12 months. When they come to Jack's Care Connect, we can help connect them to dental resources as well. And then the other shocking stat is about 80% share that their mental health or their emotional state impacts their daily life. So we're dealing with highly stressed individuals. Not surprisingly, after some of what we talked about today, they're managing a lot in their lives. So we do have some of our clinic partners. A lot of our clinic partners provide mental health services, and we've made some great partnerships in the community with other organizations that provide mental health. But that's some of the data that's not really included on the slides today. But we know that these needs are going to need to continue to be addressed, because you just can't solve one without touching the other. We can't address one without addressing the other.
Jenny, we're going to have you wrap up because you're 15 minutes up.
I have one more slide. All right, so I just wanted to wrap up with some positive trends that we are seeing. So this one is the slide that really shows us that it's working. So some of those numbers that we talked about earlier, so those individuals who said that they would go to the emergency room if they had a minor illness was 60%. After a year of Jack's Care Connect, that same question was asked, and only about 24% of our clients said that they would utilize that they would go to the emergency room for a minor illness. So that's a huge decrease and a very positive trend in the right direction. Those 75% of clients who have been to the emergency room between 1 and 3 times in the past 12 months asked the same question, only 30% said they had been to the emergency room. So this is kind of the proof is in the pudding slide, connecting people to primary care medical homes, connecting them to an advocate and to resources does reduce their use of the emergency room, which is good for taxpayers and our community, but it's also good for individual health outcomes. Thank you for your patience as I use the slide deck today. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for...
I do.
We have... Okay, we're gonna start on the panel, and then we'll go. You know, one. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Vice President. You still only got 30 seconds.
Jenny,
I'm gonna laugh for half of it. Jenny, I assume your partners are various hospitals, primary care doctors, et cetera, that you recruit all over the city. That's question number one. And question number two. I saw where you had 3 of these patient care advocates. If you had more of those, if you had 10 or 15 of those, would you have the places to place those patients, et cetera, et cetera?
Hello. Okay. So the first question is...
facilities, doctors.
Yeah, so, well... As far as the sources, we recruit partners to refer clients to us, so that's really working with our emergency rooms and educating our emergency room discharge staff and social worker staff on how to refer to Jack's Care Connect, along with any other partners out there who would be potentially interacting with our clientele. We recently worked with UNF with their clinic so they can start referring students to us. As far as like the healthcare providers, that's a clinic level operational logistics. So all of our clinic partners recruit and manage their own volunteer providers, as does, you know, WeCare Jacksonville. So Jack's Care Connect, relies on those providers, but we're not necessarily directly recruiting providers for the clinics. The second question, we could use, well, it's kind of a two-part question or answer. We would love to have a broader staff of patient health advocates because the workload that they're carrying is very intense. We also just recently started expanding to have evening and night coverage. So we have folks that are available to help clients when they're not working because sometimes they're working during the day. We fantasized about what would it look like to have a patient health advocate in every emergency room. We do have some patient health advocates who spend time in the Baptist ER, you know, certain shifts during the week, but what if they were there all the time? You know, they could just be a resource for individuals who are coming out of the ER, into the ER, and who are uninsured. So, yeah, I think staff capacity is huge, but we talked about this in the former meeting. We can't really increase staff capacity without thinking about increasing clinic capacity. Because if we start bringing thousands and thousands, we have 114,000 uninsured individuals in Duval County. If we brought them all to the clinics, we need to make sure that they can also handle that capacity.
We're ready. Bring them.
Yes. We are thinking about our clinic partners as well. So.
Okay, Dr. Mullen, any questions?
Yeah, this is, how are they getting to the emergency rooms when we know that they have some challenges with transportation? Are they utilizing our 911 emergency response in order to get to the emergency rooms?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't specifically know, but we do know a lot of them are using 911. They are using the ambulances, which are very expensive. And then often they're, if they live close by, sometimes they're walking, or sometimes they're having a friend or family member take them. But yeah, often it's a dependency on calling 911.
Second question to that Are you all connecting with our emergency responders to see if there's a way you can collaborate, maybe to help facilitate, you know, the lack, you know, not having so much utilization of those resources if it's may not be necessary for them to go to the emergency room?
Not yet, but that's a fantastic idea.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, before Jennifer asks a question, mm-hmm. if anybody have any questions, just come up to the microphone. If anyone has a question.
Transport. I hear you.
I just want to say bring the patients. We're ready.
Okay. Bob, you have any questions?
So, Jenny, what is the – I didn't see a demographic breakdown, like the age ranges that you see. I know, you know, it's kind of working for the most part. Do you have many seniors that are involved in that, and where would they go in that case?
So for our program specifically, we are addressing 18 to 65 years old.
Okay.
So when we do receive – a lot of our clinics still see individuals that are over 65. So we have a lot of we don't turn anyone away necessarily. So if someone calls us and they're ineligible by age, income, or county, we make sure we have a bucket of resources to provide for them. So if somebody was over 65, we have a couple Medicare navigators that we work with, and if they would qualify for that, we would connect them there. We would provide them with all the clinic information for the clinics that do accept over 65 as well, and then, you know, make sure they have numbers to call and kind of know what their next steps are.
And then what age, or the lower end, the children, you know, school-age kids, how many of them?
Well, we definitely help kids in the home. So if the primary client is an adult and they have kids in the home, we're going to help them connect to Florida Kid Care and understand that even if they're undocumented, they still qualify. So there's a lot of... when you're undocumented, there's a whole bunch of other questions and uncertainties that come along with that. Even if you have a SILE or a refugee status, there's still a lot of confusion. So, yeah, we absolutely will make sure we're taking care of the kids in the home as well. They won't be clients, but we're going to serve the whole house.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, do you have any other question? Okay. Does Bethany have a question? Okay, now we're going to... Let me just say your name and your organization.
Sure. Nicole Hamm, Blue Zone, Jacksonville. You spoke a lot about building a relationship with the community. What are your strategies on how to do that if they're coming in just off the street or from their situation? How are you beginning to build that relationship? And then after that, how are you maintaining that relationship and engagement to give them the wraparound care that they need?
With the clients. So we have... once they've come to us, our patient health advocates just start working with them right away. And we do honor how they like to be communicated with. Some people love the phone. Some specifically ask for email. And probably the majority of our population likes to be texted. So we figure out first, you know, how do they want to be communicated with. And we utilize a lot of our tools. We use Salesforce as our main CRM. So we have a lot of settings to follow up. We make sure that they never go more than a certain period of time without contact from their patient health advocate. So we're making sure that we're constantly following up with them. We check in with them before appointments. We check in with them after appointments. And it takes a while, but, you know, sometimes when they go to an appointment and they come home and they have a text going, hey, how'd it go? They're like, oh, that's nice. You know, I mean, it just helps to build that trust and that relationship. We keep our cases open for a year. So we don't close a case. Even if they get insured in the process, we're still going to follow up with them and just say, hey, how's that insurance going? Is it working for you? Are you seeing your primary care doctor? You know, how's this ailment going? So we just build a lot of effort into our workflow to make sure that we have a priority on building a relationship with our clients. And we hire PHAs that are empathetic people, you know, that they can relate well to people.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Susan Grish with the Health Planning Council. I have a math question.
Oh, dear.
I'm curious, there was a slide where it showed where you all calculated about $11 million in savings, somewhere over $2 million, and then somewhere over $8 million from diverting from the emergency rooms. My question is, what period of time was that over? Was that 1 year? And was that one specific ER or a group? And who was, which hospital ERs were those? And then finally,
I believe I saw that the city of Jacksonville provides $250,000 per year funding for Jack's Care Connect. So if you could answer those questions, and then I'll quickly, that might drive my next one. I'll hurry.
So I know that on the slide it has a tiny little notation about the source, and if I muck it up, I'll lean on Angela back there. But it's state data that we're getting. The FAFCC, the Florida Association of Free and Charitable Clinics, provided us data for the cost of care, and I think it's for 1 year. I believe it was from 2020 for the cost of care for somebody who's self-paying for primary care and who's self-paying for an emergency room visit. So it's not necessarily Duval-specific. It's Florida-specific data, if I'm not mistaken, and it's from the year 2020.
Okay. I was just curious, because when I initially looked at the information, and I looked at the city of Jacksonville funding, and I see UF Health is budgeted to have $40 million. I just really wondered, well, was your savings specifically at UF Health, ER, et cetera? But that might be something to gather going forward.
I think Angela's lining up to help me out here.
All right. Thank you so much.
And if I could speak to the funding question you asked about city funding up to this point in time, it is not regular funding. We were able to secure back in 2021 a $200,000 one-time grant to support not only the program but the clinics that were holding the program up through the social justice and community impact program. It's a one-time grant. We were able to secure an additional grant of $51,000 to get to the 250 number, but just recently, as part of our budget process, we've now appropriated another $98,000 to support the program. But this is not regular funding. This is really an opportunity that Councilmember Salmon and myself and others championed through the budgeting process.
So the data that was on that slide is really perfect data. I think I've said that in this group before. It's my life motto. So the cost of care was an average. So the federally qualified health centers that we work with, there is every year a program called the Uniform Data System Report. And there's a wrap-up that shows you in the state of Florida how much did it cost for each of those FQHCs to provide care for one patient for 1 year. Typically, it's about 2.5 visits in primary care, and the cost is just over what was on the slide. So we did ask our Florida Association of Free and Charitable Clinic partners if they kept a similar cost of care for all of the free clinics, and they had something within about $200 of that. So that's where we came up with what it costs to deliver care for 1 year. And so the clinic partners are contributing. For the cost of what to go to the emergency room, we actually used your data.
Okay.
So there's a great report that comes out that shows what were the conditions most seen in the emergency room. From there, we picked the ones that were probably better in primary care, things like UTIs, things like upper respiratory. And so we took what those costs were, we averaged those up together and figured out what a one visit.
The $4,000.
Yeah. Okay. And it's not the cost of the patient. We think it's the cost to the actual system of care. That's what your report shows. Okay. That's where those numbers came.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Anne Marie Knight from UF Health Jacksonville. Jenny and the entire team of Jack's Care Connect, awesome results for the first year. It's really important for this committee to understand how valuable that system of care is. I'll say from the UF Health Jacksonville standpoint, as we all know, we do not contribute to that model because we are our own standalone model, as Dr. Moulton eloquently shared, that there's $40 million sitting on the table that we provide care. I would like to formally ask that in a future meeting that I can share with the entire group exactly what that looks like for you at UF Jacksonville. We're a big geographic city. We need the work that you're doing, but what we're doing is providing care to all of our neighbors, unfortunately, who are incarcerated, who are homeless, and of course the Cheyenne's card that many people are familiar with, which is a similar model. So I propose to you, sir, that if maybe one of the future presentations I can kind of share that data to kind of get the level, because I think it's important. Just like you said, Dr. Moulton, there's lots of work that has been done that is ongoing, but yet there's still a huge opportunity for us to improve access to care. And do we define it as primary care, or do we define it in mental health? What the angle is going to be is important, but also just broad access. So I want to be sure that we include all aspects of it. Thanks for
Thank you, and we'll put you on that at the next meeting.
Thank you.
Okay. So now, the part that we all can participate in this discussion. We'll start with Paul, then Jennifer, and then if anyone has any questions, comments, or anything, please come up to the microphone after Jennifer's speech. Go ahead.
All right. So I think we've heard some great things, you know, from what's going on at Jack's Care Connect. Obviously, UF Health is doing some great work. You know, this discussion last time really centered around awareness and really making sure that people understand what was available to them, right? And so when we're starting to look at this issue as, you know, a community issue and access to healthcare, I think the primary thing that we kind of need to start at is developing this process to get the access to care or the people access to the information that they need. So you look at something like Jack's Care Connect, you look at something like, you know, what UF has with the Shands card. They don't have to stand alone. You know, they can run side by side, and we can continue to build off of the great work that's going on. And one of the other challenges and things that I've talked about, and I know I'm supposed to stay on task, so I'm going to stay on task. But you know, is making sure this story is told. You know, I said it last week or last meeting, that there is funding in this community and there is an interest in doing this type of work and improving the healthcare of this community. And so I think as we build on this effort that's going on, we continue to tell this story about the need in the community, you know, I think we could find the support that we need to really make a significant change and a sustainable change, not something that's, you know, funding every year that we're asking new administrations and others for. It's looking for some sustainability. So, you know, and sticking with that, I think, you know, we had that conversation around access and knowing what's available. And I think that's a great place to start, at least in my eyes. And again, you're all doing this work. You're all experts in this work. So I'd love to get some feedback from you as the community on what you think, but I'd also like to have Jennifer, because she's got a ton more experience than I do in this.
Well, I don't want to speak a lot because we're really here to hear from you all. But I just want to remind us all while we're here. We're in a meeting, too. We've heard what the issues are. We've heard some best practices. We're going to hear some more from Anne-Marie. And then meeting three, we're going to do a SWOT analysis. And I know everyone's like, ugh, SWOT analysis. We're going to do it fun. We might play some music, but really make it an interactive where we really hear and get everyone's feedback, and we as a collective say these are the top priorities. We've heard the data, we've heard the issues, but I want to just remind you why we're here. There are 114,000 people uninsured in our community. There are people utilizing the emergency room, which does not have follow-up care for their health. And a lot of these things are things, asthma, hypertension, diabetes. They can be managed. However, if they're not, you're going to lose your vision. You're going to lose a leg. And so by increasing access to health care, hopefully we'll get the word out about the importance of getting regular care and not waiting until things are really, really bad. And that's what people are doing, especially right now with getting out of this pandemic, which how great it is that we're all here. People didn't go to care. And so now they're showing up at our clinics sicker. They're needing more specialty care. They're showing up at hospitals sicker. So this issue is so important in the work that we're doing. And I know everyone in this room, we don't want to just have another meeting. We want to take action. We want to have action. So please, you know, this is, I don't know how much time we have left, but thoughts, comments, you know, there are minutes taken from this, and we will keep it and look at it, but we are trying to work towards action. So please, we want to hear from you, not be up here talking.
Before we go into that, I want to thank Jenny for that great presentation. Let's give her a big hand. She did a really great job. Also, I see the council president stepped in the room. Council president, you want to say something? Come on, Councilman, you got to say something. That's part of being president, to say a couple words. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I want to take a minute to, I invited Jessica from JTA to come. Perhaps more listen than talk at this point, if it's up to her to talk about the resources JTA presently provides. But I let her know how transportation is a big issue in our conversation last time. So I thought maybe Jessica should at least hear what's going on and then perhaps talk about opportunities JTA can or does bring to the table already.
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't my notes to introduce
you. Oh, I apologize. Sorry. Yes, I wasn't aware. We didn't talk.
Good afternoon. Jessica Shepler. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs and Economic Development at the Jacksonville Transportation Authority. Thank you, Councilmember Boylan, for the invite. We're happy to be here today. We look forward to working with this committee to close the gap on those transportation access issues that Jenny shared, the 27% that we see have issues getting access to these healthcare facilities. We, during the pandemic, were able to actually take healthcare to the citizens within the community by providing the necessary care during specific to the pandemic for citizens through our mobile bus operation, and it was called Wellness on Wheels. So we look forward to expanding that particular program. It's part of our five-year plan, strategic plan called MOVE 2027. And so we look forward to engaging. Our Senior Vice President of Operations looks forward to being part of this committee as well. And so just kind of talking about perhaps doing an overlay map of transportation options that we provide within the community. We have ready ride zones, 15 ready ride zones across the county. If you're talking about trying to have citizens gain access to clinics, clinics are popping up in neighborhoods all over this community, and so there's got to be, for in probably most of these zones, various clinics, and so we'd love to do like an overlay map and perhaps even a presentation of what transportation options exist and the cost associated, and perhaps come up with some great creative ideas where we can get past those barriers of cost for some of these citizens, our most vulnerable citizens. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions, but look forward to hopefully being part of the agenda at some point.
I think Council Vice President Salem has a question.
No, my question is not for her. It's okay. Separate.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I? Mr. Chair, I was at the meeting this morning on homelessness, and we had a couple of presentations from people out of this area which presented how other cities had ended homelessness. And I'm not an expert in this arena, even though I'm in healthcare. Have we looked at what other cities are doing? Have we looked at cities that have attacked this and what they have done? And could we learn from that? Pardon me?
That's meeting number four.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay, thank you. Obviously, I missed a meeting, so I didn't get the... But I think that would be very worthwhile to understand why reinvent the wheel if we can learn from what other people have done.
And I will share, as part of the group that created Jack's Care Connect, that was a big part when we met as the free clinics of what are other cities doing to address access to health care. So that this is a part of that. But not. We still need to have hear other people speak. But it was a big part of how we came up with this.
Okay, thank you.
And now we're going to go into discussion. And like I said, discussion is the most important part. We need to hear from the experts, and that's why we're here. So, do we have any questions or comments? Discussion. No questions or comments. Okay, Paul. You got anything?
No, I'll just say, so we are looking at some other cities that are doing it. I know there's Healthy Miami Gardens that UF Health just went down and learned a little bit about, so I've been doing some research on that report. I can send it over to Pamela so we can get that out as well. I think they did some nice things to start out with. I have talked to my colleagues. We have 20 bold goal communities. Jacksonville was one of the bold goal communities for Humana. So we're working on a lot of these efforts. You know, we start to talk about mobile food pantries, mobile food pharmacies that, you know, they can bring food to patients that have, you know, significant health issues, chronic health issues, and starting to look at that. So I think there's a lot that is being done across the communities, across the country. Please explore and bring some ideas. You know, don't be afraid to share. That's the best way to do it. Learn from somebody else's failures and successes, and take take the ability to build off of that.
Jennifer, anything else? You wanna add? Do we have any public comment? No public comment. Well, this meeting is adjourned.